Sir,
I'm going to
this is the interview of Richard H. Rowe on behalf of the SEC Historical Society, Topics for Oral History. The date is May 24th, 2004.
Okay.
The location is Mr. Rowe's offices at Proskauer Rose at 1233 20th Street Northwest, Suite 800 in Washington, D.C. The time is approximately 9 o'clock in the morning Eastern Daylight Time. And this is an interview of Richard H. Rowe, who worked at the SEC and left as the Director of the Division of Corporation Finance. My first question, Mr. Rowe, is what was your educational background and how did it prepare you to work at the SEC?
Well, John, I'll start with high school, where I took an aptitude test, and the results of that test were that I should be a financial reporter for a financial publication. I decided not to follow that career, and I went to college, which didn't really prepare me for the SEC at all. Majored in history and politics. Then I went in the Marine Corps after college. I think that helped me at the SEC because it taught me that I could stand up to anybody.
What was your rank in the Marine Corps?
I was released from active duty, honorably, I might say, with the rank of first lieutenant. I then went on to law school at Harvard. Again, although it's a great education in the Socratic method that was being used in those days, there was very little practical education. I took a course from the then leading light in the securities field, and Professor Louis Loss, but I must say there was no practical application in Mr. Loss's class. In fact, Mr. Loss said it would be beneath the dignity of a great law school to teach you anything practical, and that's almost a direct quote. Although he did give me a good backing in statutory interpretation, particularly Section 5 of the Securities Act of 1933, which I've never forgotten.
It's a very interesting observation, first lieutenant of the Marine Corps. The first time I ever met Dick Rowe was when I was interviewing for a job in the Division of Corporation Finance. I was just getting out of the Army and had then gone to law school, and I was a first lieutenant in the Army. So when he hired me, it was one first lieutenant hiring another first lieutenant. Next question. What interested you in the SEC?
Well, when I was in my first year of law school, I started inquiring around as to, I wanted to do government service. I had no thoughts in those days of going to a law firm. And I started inquiring around, and I was advised, I don't remember by whom, that the three best places to work in the summer in Washington were the appellate division of the NLRB, the civil division of the Justice Department, and the Securities and Exchange Commission. You know, I applied to all three. I didn't hear from them, and I, between my Marine Corps service and starting law school, I had some time, and I took a civil service exam. So while I was waiting to hear from these agencies, I received an offer for a temporary appointment as a GS-9, I believe, as a management analyst at the Veterans Administration. I needed the money. It was a lot more than I would have made at any of the agencies that I had applied to, so I took that job.
What year are we talking about?
This must have been 1962. After I accepted the job, I got a call from the SEC, and they said, we have this special study going on. We'd like you to come over there and work for us. There's a little story behind that. The reason that I got the offer from the SEC, I think, is that I had helped save the life of the head of the then Postal Office and Civil Service Committee in the House of Representatives. I helped pull him out of a fire, and he was sort of indebted to me, and I suspect that he had something to do with my getting that offer. But in any event, I had committed to the Veterans Administration, and I went there. But the SEC said, please contact us after your second year. I worked at the Veterans Administration. It soured me forever on management analysts, I must say. The next year, I applied to the SEC. I got a job as a summer law clerk in the branch of administrative proceedings and investigations in the Division of Corporation Finance. In those days, each of the major divisions had its own enforcement office. And that branch of administrative proceedings and investigations was that in the Division of Corporation Finance. At that time, the commission was made up of Barney Whitside, who was a former director of the Division of Corporation Finance, Jack Whitney, a practitioner from who had been a practitioner from Chicago, former Senator Freer, William Carey, who had been a professor at Columbia Law School, and Manny Cohen, another former director of Corporation Finance. As a summer law clerk, I had very little contact with the commission.
Who did you work with on the staff of the commission when you first joined?
Ed Worthy was director of Division of Corporation Finance. At the time, I thought Alan Levinson ran the branch of administrative proceedings and investigations because of his strong personality, and I worked directly with him. It turned out that there was actually a man named Ben Levy, who I almost never saw, who was actually the head of the office. But anyway, I worked directly with Alan, and in those days it was a smaller staff, and there was a lot of contact with the director. Ed was a very gregarious person. Actually, this was back in 1963, and the government was still on a half day on Saturdays, so we would show up on Saturdays and sit around in Ed's office and shoot the breeze, which nothing very much substantive got taken care of, but we were getting paid for half a day at least.
Did you work on any interesting cases while you worked there?
I worked almost entirely on a case called Atlantic Research, and just because this is a historical society interview, this is the history. There was this was an off-balance sheet case, which is a buzzword these days. But what was happening is Atlantic Research was a government, mainly government research organization down in Virginia, and they, or at least the top executives allegedly, had cooked up this scheme where they dumped all of their bad assets and a lot of their liabilities on a little company in Texas called Texas Capital Investments, which was run out of the garage by a friend of the chief executive officer of the company. The case was ultimately settled. The position of the staff was that Texas Capital Investments ought to be consolidated. Accountants rose up in arms and said, "You can't consolidate. You don't own 51% of the stock." Andy Barr, the then chief accountant of the commission, backed the accountants. And I don't recall exactly what the form was, but there was a set of financial statements cobbled together with a black line running down. And on one side, you had the historical financial statements of Atlantic Research, and on the other side, you had Texas Capital Investments. But there's another interesting aspect of this case. I don't recall whether it was when I returned to the commission as a lawyer or when I was still a law clerk, but there were a lot of private civil actions brought against Atlantic Research, and Alan Levinson had persuaded the commission to make the entire investigatory record public, and it was put in a room on the first floor of the commission's offices, which were then in a tar paper shack over off 4th Street, I guess.
Yeah,
it was.
4th and E.
And one day I got a summons to go to the room. There's a lawyer there named Sidney Silverman, and he said, "I'm just a sole practitioner in New York. I have this case. I need you to take me through this record," which was, you know, it was piled high to the ceiling. And first of all, I didn't think that was ethically the right thing to do, and second, I didn't, although I'd worked on the case, I didn't have all that much knowledge of this massive record, and third, I knew that this guy was working with Abe Pomerantz, the classic class action lawyer of his day, the Milberg Weiss of his day, so I refused to do it.
What was the fallout for your refusal?
Nothing. You know, there was, as I say, you know, you stand up to people, and if you're right, usually nothing happens.
Why did you decide to return to the commission after graduating from law school?
Oh, I had a wonderful experience that summer. And as I said, I thought that this was the place to come, or one of the three places to come anyway. And I got the offer, and in those days it was a lot of money. It was $7,500 a year, John, believe it or not.
When I started, it was $17,000 a year, and that was a huge increase from $11,000 for a first lieutenant in the Army.
Yes, well, I have been making $222 a month.
And what year are we talking about?
We're talking about 1964. And I had just recently become married. We had a child on the way. And I got into the honors program at the commission. And as soon as I passed the bar, my salary went up to a munificent $9,000 a year.
A $1,500 raise.
Yes. But in those days, you know, that was...
Major league.
Major league, yeah.
And outline your progress after you started again as a permanent staff member.
Well, I was an attorney, a trial attorney was my title. I worked on cases there for a couple of years and then had an opportunity to become a legal assistant to Frank Wheat, who was then on the commission, and I jumped at that opportunity. I worked with Frank for a couple of years, which was about the limit for legal assistants in those days. Interviewed with Frank possible predecessors, and the one that was chosen was Mr. Harvey Pitt, actually. I then had some experiences which sort of soured me on the commission a little bit. When it became clear that I was leaving Frank's office, Dick Phillips and Mike Eisenberg in the general counsel's office said, well, why don't you come here? We can get you a GS-14, which was another promotion, and you can work with us. Well, I liked both of them, and I said, fine. And the time came for me to go into the general counsel's office, and the general counsel spoke to me, and he said, it was Phil Loomis. To me, the greatest general counsel the commission ever had. But Phil said, well, look, you don't have any experience in brief writing, which is the main thing that we do, and Phil was the best brief writer ever came across this earth. Frank Wheat used to say, Phil wrote briefs in the iambic pentameter. So Phil said, look, why don't we make you a GS-13, and you know, we'll try you out. Well, I think he was right, actually. But I didn't think he was right at the time. And with a couple of kids, the promotion meant something to me. So Don Levinson said, well, why don't you come back to Corp Finn? We'll get you the grade. So that was all well and good, except Alan left and went out to California to be with Shareholders Management Company, and Charlie Shreve, who was then the director of the division, Edwardian, had passed away with a heart attack, said essentially the same thing as Phil. Well, he didn't say it. He said, look, we'll give you a GS-13. Well, I was already a GS-13. I said, look, I had been promised a GS-14. I think it would be fair that I came back because of that. And he grudgingly said okay, and I was a special counsel in his office. But I was starting to wonder, is this the place for me? And I started looking around. As a rulemaker, John, you'll appreciate, though, I'll give you one little story about working in Charlie's office. I had some responsibility for the rulemaking and drafting the releases on the rulemaking. I can't even remember now. And there was another lawyer there, Ed Shevlin, who had been doing this for years and years and years. And they gave me an assignment, and I wrote a release of 10 pages explaining the rule. I get called into Charlie's office. Ed's sitting there. Charlie throws the draft at me and says, that's not the way we write rules in this office. And Ed writes a 3-page release. As you know, as the years went on, there was a case, National Resources Defense Council against the SEC, a rulemaking case, where which went on for a number of years. The commission eventually prevailed, but the judge initially said there wasn't enough explanation about the rule. Harvey Pitt, who was then the general counsel, got a hold of that, and now the commission writes 400-page releases, not 4-page releases. But anyway, so I was a little upset about how things were going, although it was progressing. I started looking around. I interviewed with one law firm where a friend of mine, Jeff Bauman, who had actually been one of the three people when I came on at 64 who would come onto the division. Jeff's now a professor at Georgetown. He said, why don't you try Arnold & Porter? So I interviewed there and actually asked them some very difficult questions and told them I didn't want to review registration statements. And they said, of course you wouldn't have to do that. And Jeff told me, of course you will have to. Any of that. Then I got a call from Al Levinson inviting me to go out to California and work for the mutual fund management company, more specifically for a closed-end fund that invested in private placement. And the salary was a munificent $18,000 a year and an opportunity to get stock options. So I decided to accept that. I called the partner at Arnold Porter and told him that I declined their offer. And he said, well, what did they offer you? Maybe we can get you some more. And I told him $18,000, and he laughed and he said, take it. In those days, lawyers, at least here in Washington, were pretty much closer to the salary level of the commission than they certainly are today. The difference was that there was a year-end bonus that the commission employees didn't get, but the salary levels were about the same, and they were for several years after that. Anyway, I went out to California, moved my family out there. My wife got a job as an assistant producer of a television program in L.A., and we were doing pretty well. In fact, probably better than I've ever done. It was $18,000 in those days. It went a long way.
This is 1969.
This is 1969. And it was sort of an exciting time. There were a number of SEC alumni out there. There's Alan Gordon, who had been chief counsel of the division of what now is the Division of Investment Management. Alan Levinson. Gay Danahill, who had been a financial analyst and investigator in a branch of administrative proceedings and investigation, and or a few other people out there. And it was an enjoyable time. And then, things started to happen. The management company was taken over. I had liked the people who were out there when I first went out there. I didn't dislike the people who took it over, but they were of a different breed, shall I say. The people who had been running it were sort of the old school investment managers. The people who took it over were much more aggressive and wanted to branch out into a lot of other areas of financial management. And for that and other reasons, and then Alan Levinson left to come back to be director of Corp Fin.
What year was that?
1970. So I started looking around again, and law firms, and considering the commission, going back to the commission, because Alan said he wanted me to come back there. And I interviewed at a couple of law firms here in D.C. and one in Chicago. Actually, the one in Chicago was interesting because it was when I got out there, they said, "Well, we're sorry you can't meet Brad Cook." Who's our securities guy. Well, Brad eventually became, I didn't meet him, and he eventually became chairman of the commission, but general counsel and chairman. But they took me to the house of one of the partners to stay that night, and I get up in the morning and I look out on the vast expanse of the lawn and the garden and everything. Well, it turned out it was a replica of the governor's mansion at Williamsburg. I said, wow, this is how you practice But eventually I decided, you know, I'll go to the commission. And Hamer Budge was then the chairman of the commission, and Alan had suggested I talk to him about being the chief counsel of Court 10. And I talked to Hamer, and he said, no, that's already promised, sorry. And it turned out it was Neil McCoy, but to be the chief counsel, he'd been administrative or a legal assistant to Hamer, and I ended up in the chief counsel's office for a short period of time. And then Ralph Tracy, who had been heading the Office of Administrative Proceedings and Investigations, became a hearing examiner, which now is an administrative law judge, and I got that position. Things just went on from there.
So Charlie Treve died of a heart attack,
yeah.
And he succeeded Ed Worthy, who died of a heart attack.
Right.
So heart problems and division directors go sort of hand in hand.
Well, hopefully not, John. The two of us are still sitting.
And in good spirits, I might add.
Yes, but and eventually Manny Cohen, did, after going into private practice, did pass away from a heart attack, too.
Once you returned in 1970 and was working in the division again, did you work on interesting cases? What was the workload like?
Well, first of all, let me explain that the office in Court Finn handled mostly administrative proceedings, but after I took over, we started to, one, work with other offices on civil actions, and two, we got limited authority to go to court to enforce the reporting provisions of the 34 Act. And there were a number of those cases, and we won them all, and one case was the only case I ever argued in a court on a motion for summary judgment, which I won and decided I would quit while I was ahead.
But what case was that?
I don't even remember, but it was a case where the president of the company came from Texas to argue pro se that we shouldn't put this little company out of business by forcing it to file reports with the SEC. And I felt sorry for him in a little way, but I had to argue for my clients. So my argument was, look, these people went public. They promised the public that there would be reports. And, Your Honor, you just can't not enter this injunction. So I don't know whatever happened to the company, but we did win on the motion.
But in essence, people from the division went into court.
In those cases, yes. But again, in those days, most cases were settled anyway. But there were two cases that have a historical significance, I would say. One was an administrative proceeding that was settled in the matter of Great Southwest Corporation. And that was a revenue recognition case. You will recognize the term revenue recognition, which half of the commission's cases these days are revenue. But this was a sale of an amusement park, or amusement parks, I guess, plural. And our argument was that the risks of ownership and the rewards of ownership, or the risks of ownership didn't pass and the rewards of ownership were kept by the ostensible sellers. And for a change, our accounting, that's unfair, not for change. We were fully supported by the chief accountant's office and the accounting profession, and that solidified some positions in the law. But by far the most interesting case, I would have to say, is the National Student Marketing case, which was the first case where the commission really took off after reputable law firms, shall I say. And that came about because a young lawyer in my office who had been investigating the matter came to me and said, I don't know what to do. The lawyers are in on this. They knew all about it. And I said, I'll tell you what you do. You go and keep investigating and get the facts, and then we'll decide what we're going to do. So he did. I decided to take the deposition of one of the lawyers involved, and I only mention that because in questioning him, I said, look, I would like you to go back and ask your client to waive the attorney-client privilege so that we can fully investigate this matter. And this lawyer, who was a very experienced lawyer, kept insisting that the privilege was that of the law firm and not the client's. So I eventually I just dropped that. But so we couldn't bring those kinds of cases in court. So I went to Pat Sondi, who I think was still in the general counsel's office at the time, because there was no division of enforcement. And Ted became interested in the case. We worked together. We went to the commission. We anticipated, because of the charges we were recommending to be brought against law firms, that we would have problems with the commission, but the commission had no problem. They approved the case. At that time, or at about around that time, the Wells Commission had made its report to the commission, and the recommendation which the commission adopted was that at the commission's discretion, a prospective defendant had an opportunity to make a submission to the staff, which would then perhaps be brought onto the commission, but would try to explain what was going on. In this case, in the National Food Marketing case, we learned that there was going to be a leak to the newspapers. As far as I can recall, somebody had left a complaint sitting on their desk, and a reporter had seen the complaint.
In other words, the reporter had access to the staff areas.
Wandering around in the staff's areas, yes. Now, I don't think they could do that these days, but in those days they could.
They could still do that when I was around in the early 1980s.
So we went to the commission, and it became important to bring the action immediately rather than waiting around for Wells submissions. So the case was brought. It later became an issue that that they weren't given an opportunity to make a Wells submission, but it exactly how it was ruled. But the upshot of it was that this was not an absolute right; that it was in the discretion of the commission to permit this sort of thing to be submitted, and it may have been if we hadn't had that threat of a leak.
And then, what was the resolution of National Student Marketing?
Well, there were several resolutions, but the law firms ended up consenting, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them did, some of them didn't. There was one case here in the district where the judge said the lawyers should have done something, but more than they did, but court never said what that something was. But it changed practice in that as you know, we now, most law firms have second partner reviews of opinions. Opinions were at issue in that case, and one of the settling law firms said, well, as part of the settlement, we'll have a second partner review our opinions, at least in securities cases. And the rest of the bar jumped on the bandwagon, and I think that was a good thing. The commission received lots of pressure after the case was brought, but they held fast, and Brad Cook, at the time the case was brought, was the chairman of the commission, I think, or at least I think he was the chairman.
Mm-hmm. 1974? 75?
75, I believe,
yeah.
Right around there. I'd like to backtrack a little bit. There was one other. My career is about to leave enforcement, but there was one other case that I had very little to do with, and that was Texas Gulf. I was on Frank Wheat's staff at the time.
This is back in 1968.
68, 69.
Right.
And the commission was going over the brief in that case, because they filed an amicus brief. They filed a brief in the appellate court. And that was a groundbreaking case, and Frank Wheat and the other commissioners went over that brief with a fine-tooth comb, and that set a lot of law. Okay, now let's move on to...
We're into post-National Student Marketing, and we're into, in essence, the creation of enforcement while you were there.
Yes. There were... Bill Casey became the chairman. Bill was a wonderful guy. he would listen to the staff. It was easy access to him. He got along very well with Stanley Sporkin.
What was Stanley's job at that time? Enforcement was created.
Irv Pollack was the head of the Division of Trading and Markets, and Stanley was his associate director and handling enforcement cases, and that's where a lot of the enforcement cases came out of. And Bill, as I say, would listen to people and generally would take their advice, but it frustrated him at times. And particularly the enforcement cases that were coming out of CorpFin and out of Trading and Markets. And he had a management study done. And the upshot of that it was inefficient to have 3-4 different enforcement shops, and that ought to be combined into one, a division of enforcement.
Mm-hmm.
This all happened. The actual it was all I was interviewed by the management analysts, my favorite people, days at the Veterans Administration. And the upshot was this recommendation, which was kept pretty close because I wasn't aware of the recommendation, and I was off on a holiday with my family. And ordinarily, I told people generally where I was going to be, but then plans would change. And we were at one of the beaches in the eastern shore of Maryland, and decided we'd get on a ferry and go over to the New Jersey shore. And
Cape May Ferry.
Cape May Ferry, and then go up and visit my grandparents in Maine, drive up that way. And nobody knew we were going to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And we're about to get on the ferry, and I hear the loudspeaker saying my name, and would you go to the phone and call this number. And somehow Alan Levinson had tracked me down, and he said, hi. I said, how long do you want to keep playing the game of cops and robbers? And I said, well, what do you mean? He said, well, we've just done this reorganization, created the Division of Enforcement. You can go down there, or you can stay here and become an associate director of disclosure policy. And I said, well, I think I'll take the disclosure policy job, which was a good career decision, I think. I hated to leave the enforcement shop where we had a bunch of really good lawyers and very close camaraderie. Carl Stewart and David Belkin, Dick Nessen, who's now general counsel of mm-hmm. the Depository Trust Company's holding company, to name a few. And we had some great times there. We had a basketball team that played on weekends until I cracked my head on the cement floor that we were playing on and decided at 35 I was going to give up this game. But there are a couple of humorous stories coming out of there. One, in those days, things were different. There were parties at the commission, and sometimes something stronger than Coca-Cola was served at those parties. And our office used to have a party on Fridays, and the liquor was kept in a locked cabinet in Carl Stewart and Dick Nessen's office. People shared offices. And we also had bomb scares in those days. And we had a bomb scare, and they would, whoever the bomb squad was would go around, I don't know, with dogs or whatever, sniffing around. And all of a sudden, the loudspeaker comes on again with Dick Nessen and Carl Stewart, please report to their office. Well, they had found a locked file drawer, and they wanted to inspect another box. They had to open it up. Nothing came from that.
Did they lose their liquor?
I don't recall.
Good answer.
I don't recall. But if they did, it was replaced. But the between bomb scares and presidential alerts and emergencies, it was interesting.
A lot of fun.
I remember one Saturday being called in. There was an emergency that the president had declared, and all of the top staff and the commission had to appear at the commission, which I think this was after we went over to 450 or on North Capitol Street.
Mm-hmm.
And
500 North Capitol.
500 North Capitol. And I showed up, and I showed him my ID, and this gentleman comes up behind me, and I don't have an ID. Well, it's Irv Pollack, who was then on the commission,
mm-hmm.
commissioner. The guard who's sitting there had seen him come in every day, knew he was a commissioner. He said, "No, sir, I'm sorry, you have to have an ID." And I finally persuaded the guard, "I'll swear for this guy." He's a company. But in any event.
The guards haven't changed, incidentally, over the years.
No.
So the Division of Enforcement was created, and Irv Pollack became the first director of the Division of Enforcement, and Stanley went to enforcement, and the people that you work with in Corp Fin, in the administrative proceedings section, did they go to enforcement too?
Most of them did for a while. Dick Nesson went there and then became general counsel of the Municipal Securities Rulemaking Board and then went on to DTC. Some of the others went down there for a while and moved on into private practice. I think John Burness, who had been in the office, stayed on at the commission for quite some time and then went left, and the last, John's passed away now, but he was working with an international organization which would, on a very limited fee basis, provide advice to foreign governments, which he tried to get me involved in, but then he went on to better things, maybe.
I think we're going to turn the tape. Bear with us. We're going to try recording again, and we're going to see if the tape ends anytime soon. So, Dick, what about Robert Vesco, and what do you remember about the Vesco case?
Well, after Stanley became director of division, and I was director of Corp Fin, I would get Sporkin summoned.
Sporkin summonses?
Yeah.
What's a Sporkin summons?
Well, for me it was, I'd be sitting in my office doing my job, and all of a sudden I'd get a call, "Stanley wants you in his office," or "Stanley wants you at the commission table," and I would walk in and, you know, there would be a bunch of people sitting around, and Sporkin would be working on a settlement or you know, trying to convince these people that they were bad people or that their clients were bad people, and Stanley would ask me, "What do you think about this?" I would sit there and say, "Stanley, if you really want me to tell these people what I think about this, I think we better go someplace else to talk about it first." But Stanley would, you know, throw out ideas, and sometimes they would work, sometimes they wouldn't work. But to respond to your question, one of the Sporkin summons was come down to Stanley's office, and I walk in, and there's Robert Vesco and a battery of lawyers and a bunch of enforcement people, and Stanley says, "Sit down." I sit down. Stanley said, "You know, you can ask this guy some questions about the filings with the commission." I said, "Stanley, I'm not named in the order." And he said, "Ah, don't worry about that." I said, "Stanley, look, for me to ask questions, I think I ought to be named in the order. And by the way those orders work, you can name me in a supplemental order." "Oh, no, I'm not going to bother you." So I turned to the lawyer who was representing Vesco, and I said, "Do you have any objection to my asking questions without being..."
This entire conversation happened in the presence of the lawyer for Robert Vesco?
Yeah.
Okay.
So I said, "Do you have any objection to my asking questions without being named in the order? Mr. Sporkin could adjourn the proceeding and name me in the order if that was necessary." "Yeah, no objection." So I start asking Mr. Vesco if he had seen the 10K, for example. Well, I don't remember. Did you sign it? Well, it looks like my signature, you know. Those kinds of questions, mm-hmm. try to pin him down that he'd seen this report, and he had signed the report, and he was very evasive. I asked a series of questions, and then finally gave up. And then, just as an aside, we're sitting around. I guess there was a break going on, and Vesco turns to Stanley, and he says, "Stanley, you've got a very nice house, and you have very cute children, very nice children." Stanley looks at him and says, "What do you mean?" He says, "I have pictures of all of them." Stanley picks up the phone, and the conversation's going on around the table. Stanley called the FBI on Vesco. So that kind of shows you the kind of man that Vesco was.
Vesco just pointed this out right in the middle of the conversation without any lead-in or any reason? Did his lawyer try to stop him?
Not that I recall. I don't know that the lawyer controlled Mr. Vesco. Anyway, that case eventually, Mr. Vesco fled the jurisdiction.
Yes, the fund of funds case.
Yes, and he had a U.S. company that was also subject to commission proceedings, and there was a civil action in New Jersey, I think. And it was a procedural matter, but all I can recall is that the court cited as the right for the commission to continue as they were continuing, but they cited the portions of the transcripts that I had taken without attributing it to me.
Never came back to haunt you then?
No.
Okay, when were you named as division director? What were the circumstances in which you became the director of the Division of Corporation Finance, and which number director, if you can recall, are you?
I'm not good at numbers, but I can tell you who my predecessors were.
Okay.
There was Baldwin Bain, who was the first director, who came over from the Federal Trade Commission.
And he was from 1934 to 1951.
Something like that. And then Barney Woodside succeeded him. Barney went on the commission. Manny Cohen succeeded Barney. Manny went on the commission. Ed Worthy succeeded Manny. Ed passed away. Charlie Shreve succeeded him. Charlie passed away. Al Levinson succeeded him. Then I succeeded Alan when Alan went into private practice. And you know the story from then.
Right. Baldwin Bain, Barney Woodside, Manny Cohen, Ed Worthy, Charlie Shreve, Alan Levinson. That's 3, 6. You're the seventh.
I think that's right.
By that? Okay.
Seven in, let's see.
From 1934 to 1970. 76.
Okay. So, division directors serve longer than chairman of the commission.
Yes.
On the average.
Right.
On the average.
Well, after Baldwin Bain for 17 years, he broke the average.
Well, I spent however many years I did as associate director of disclosure policy. Alan Levinson left to go into private practice.
At Fulbright and Jaworski.
At Fulbright and Jaworski here in D.C. The position was open for a while. While all this had been going on, the commission, Alan and Stanley, put together the first voluntary disclosure program, or the first cooperation program, relating to foreign payments, and people would come into either CorpFin or enforcement and reveal information about foreign payments that were questionable, and depending upon how it came out, they may or may not be proceeded against, or they might have been proceeded against with something lesser than a maximum sanction.
This is before the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act was passed.
And then the commission put together a report to Congress. I think that the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act bills were pending in Congress. The commission put together a report outlining the volunteers that had come in, and but without identifying them. And that was submitted to Congress. I had worked on that report. We got we were subpoenaed by a House committee, by a couple of lawyers who were real, shall we say, aggressive investigators, but didn't know what they were doing. And the commission had encountered them in other cases. Is the tape still there?
Yeah, I think so. Bear with us. We're going to check the tape again.